Rochester's weekday sports beat on your home of the Irish. 96.1 FM, WSBT.
Martin for three. Got it!
The Clay Colonials win the state championship.
Notre Dame has beaten number one BC. Over the boards come the Irish.
Comes win.
Her shot is up. No good. And the Fighting Irish of Notre Dame have won the national championship.
Ryan Newman, Roger Penske. Wow. Win the Daytona 500.
The Stanley Cup to the Chicago Blackhawks.
The Irish is upset. Florida State. Notre Dame is number one.
Here are your hosts, Darren Pritchett and Sean Stiers.
Good to be with you on this Monday, July the 24th of 2017. Sean back at our WSBT studios in Mishawaka. I'm Darren with the South Bend Cubs on the road for one more day in Beloit, Wisconsin as we wrap up a six-game road trip. First pitch tonight is at 8 o'clock. Pre-game coverage at 7:45 on 96.1 FM. WSBT, Tyson Miller on the mound for South Bend against Kyle Toomey, who pitched for South Bend last year. He'll be on the mound for the Snappers for the 8 o'clock first pitch on WSBT Radio. Well, believe it or not, we're probably about a week away from Brian Kelly meeting the media to kick off Notre Dame football fall practice. Practice is going to get underway probably right around the 1st of August. The Culver experience for the players will kick things off, I assume, and then back to campus to get ready for the season opener September the 2nd against Temple at Notre Dame Stadium. Every game on WSBT Radio kick off that day at 3:30, and our pregame coverage will start bright and early at 9 a.m. and go all the way through the official Notre Dame football postgame show, which normally takes us up until right around midnight. So we are looking forward to getting football started here on WSBT Radio, and of course Sports Speed will be heavy football the rest of the way through this regular season, and hopefully some good things in January as well. Mr. Stiers, hope you had a good weekend.
I did. Had a nice, restful, low-stress weekend. It's always good considering all that you just talked about with all that's coming. We're going to get busy here pretty quick.
Yeah, it's going to be coming fast and furious with the Irish getting ready for this brand-new season. And we're going to talk some Notre Dame football recruiting news in just a second. And later on in this hour, our Notre Dame Fall Camp Preview Series will continue by focusing on starting quarterback Brandon Wimbush and mixing in some audio from Brandon from spring practice. So we'll get to that coming up in a little bit. And our My Five question of the day today is Notre Dame football related. And today, who will be Notre Dame's five leading tacklers this fall? This was actually Friday's question. We ran out of time, so we moved it to today. So we'll get to that list coming up. I don't think there's probably going to be much argument about number one. And then two through five could get a little interesting. 6 o'clock hour, we have rapid fire. We're going to do little odds and ends. We're just going to pick a few topics from the weekend and discuss those. And we'll wrap things up with a little South Bend Cubs conversation and maybe a Major League Baseball topic or two. But we can update you right now. The White Sox-Cubs series got underway this afternoon at Wrigley Field. And the Cubs start today in first place in the National League Central. They have caught the Brewers already after trailing by 5.5 coming out of the All-Star break. Chicago coming off winning 2 out of 3 against St. Louis the last 3 days, including last night's victory. So a quick turnaround for the Cubs playing an afternoon game at home against the crosstown rivals. And right now the White Sox are beating the Cubs 3-1 with Chicago batting in their half of the eighth inning. And so far in this ball game, and unfortunately being in Beloit, which is too close to Chicago, you can't watch the game because of the stupid blackout rules that we have in Major League Baseball. Someday I really hope we get these taken care of. But in the meantime, I watch on Game Tracker, I listen a little bit on the radio and do the best I can, but the Cubs actually jumped in front 1-0 in the second inning. Kyle Hendricks, fresh off the DL, starting for the first time in 7 weeks, picked up an RBI on a ground out, scoring Ben Zobrist. Cubs led 1-0 going to the third. In the fifth inning, the White Sox tied it up against Hendricks. Jose Abreu, a double to right field, scoring Abisail Garcia. That tied the game at 1. Jason Grimm entered the ballgame at that point. He came back for the sixth inning and gave up a home run to Adam Engel. And Engel had three RBI yesterday in the White Sox loss to the Royals. Homers today, his third of the year. And the White Sox had a 2-1 lead. And then in the eighth inning against Koji Uehara, Matt Davidson ripped a home run to left field, his 19th of the year, and the White Sox have built a 3-1 advantage over the Cubs this afternoon. And Hendricks, as I mentioned, starting for the first time in 7 weeks, had that finger injury, got him on the DL. Several rehab starts, now back in the rotation. All things considered, not awful, having not pitched in a major league game in a while. 4 1/3 innings, 8 hits, an earned run, no walks, 5 strikeouts. It was a high pitch count, as he needed 92 pitches to record 13 outs and threw 61 strikes. So I'm not sure the expectations of Joe Maddon coming into today with Kyle Hendricks. Hit total was a little high. The pitch count was a little high. But at the same time, all you probably ask from Hendricks today is give your team a chance to win the ball game. And going to the fifth inning, tied at 1, he got the job done. But for some reason, the Cubs are mystified by Miguel Gonzalez, of all people.
No kidding. I mean,
I don't get that.
I was sitting there listening to the game earlier today, and they did have the bases loaded, I think, an inning ago. Are they in the seventh now, going to the eighth? Yeah, they're going to
eighth
the
inning, yes.
Yeah, they're in the eighth now, so it was the seventh inning. Had the bases loaded. Chris Bryant walked. They kind of pitched around him, and you would have thought that they might have been able to break things open. Anthony Rizzo flied out to the wall. But, you know, watching the White Sox against Kansas City over the weekend, their bullpen blew leads all weekend long against the Royals, and so you would wonder now if that's going to be the script as well for the Cubs. But they have just not hit the ball. They haven't strung anything together all day. John Jay's 4-for-4, but the only RBI that the Cubs have had all day is the pitcher who hasn't pitched in almost two months. So go figure.
Well, the Royals are only a game and a half out of first now. They've won 5 in a row, so the Indians have a new pursuer. It's been the Twins for a while now. The Royals are sitting right there in the co-pilot seat, I guess, with the Indians at 50-47. So I guess the Royals' good play lately has made the decision pretty easy for the front office heading toward the non-waiver trade deadline.
Yeah, there's no doubt they've got to be buyers if they can. I still don't know that they're going to be able to add anything, but I'm like you with that blackout rule. Now, this is the second series against the Tigers in the last week, but you can't watch any of them here, even with the MLB package, because technically we're considered part of that Detroit market. So,
yeah. And Cincinnati considers South Bend their home market. I appreciate that. That
exactly
makes so much sense. So much sense. Well, again, they're in the eighth inning at Wrigley Field. White Sox 3, Cubs 1, and John Jay just picked up a bunt single for his fourth hit. So it's first and second, two outs for the Cubs, with Javi Baez stepping to the plate against, looks like, Dan Jennings. So game may be on the line in the eighth inning as the White Sox try to figure out a way to close out a game late with their bullpen that looks a whole lot different, with David Robertson now playing for the Yankees and Tyler Clippard now allegedly the closer for the Southsiders. And they're going to bring in Anthony Swarzyk to face Javier Baez, and Swarzyk's got a 2.30 ERA and 10 holds this year, so his job is to retire Javier Baez as the go-ahead run at home plate in the bottom of the eighth inning.
Clippard gave up the game-winning hit to your old buddy Brandon Moss yesterday. So
I saw that. Came in for one batter, gave up the hit, and that's all she wrote, as the Sox let that one slip away, giving up a run in the eighth and a run in the ninth. Well, yesterday we got some Notre Dame football recruiting news, as the Irish yesterday picked up a verbal commitment from a North Carolina running back by the name of Jameer Smith. On Twitter, he wrote, quote, "I gave my blood, sweat, tears. I'm committed. Hashtag Irish bound Indy 18. Hashtag we are Indy." Now, 247sports.com. lists Jameer Smith as the 24th best running back in the class of 2018, and they list him as a three-star prospect. 2,140 rushing yards down in Carolina last year with 40 rushing touchdowns, and apparently he picked the Fighting Irish over schools like North Carolina, Louisville, Nebraska, USC, and Tennessee. I know they have the crystal ball on the 247sports.com website. And yesterday when I checked it out, I think they had North Carolina as an 83% favorite to acquire the home state running back, Jameer Smith, and Notre Dame was at 17%. So it turned out perfectly for the Fighting Irish as they pick up their 13th commitment in the class of 2018 and their second running back joining Cathedral's Marquis Stepp. And I guess from my standpoint, Sean, as I take a look at having two members of this class being running backs, you have to wonder about the future of Josh Adams, and this is a positive thing, that if he has a really big junior season this year, I mean, there's a pretty good chance he'll enter the NFL draft, and I can't blame running backs compared to a lot of positions. When you get a lot of wear and tear off the tires in the college game, I mean, it does hurt you in the National Football League. The good thing, everybody's sharing carries, so I guess it's easier to keep tread on the tire, but I guess with the way Notre Dame is constructed with their offensive line and a healthy Josh Adams could lead to a big year leading to his departure. And then all of a sudden the numbers get a little light at the running back position next year with Dexter Williams, Tony Jones Jr., C.J. Holmes. And now you add Marquis Stepp from Cathedral High School and Jameer Smith. So to me, I almost feel like this is a very important commitment, even though it may not show up a whole lot and a lot of blogs and people getting excited, but just with the possibility of Adams leaving, it just seems like two running backs in this class puts them in a much more comfortable position in case Adams has that big year, which we hope he does, and has a decision to make after the season.
Absolutely. I think you have to, especially with this run first mentality that we heard about. I mean, you've got to have backs and you've got to have the bodies in there to do it. And so you have to assume, CJ Procise, no one thought that he was leaving after 1 year as running back, but he did. He headed to the NFL after that. The numbers were pretty thin there for a while, which is why CJ was back there. So you have to keep bringing in those bodies and have some good explosive breakaway type guys. And just watching the video on this guy, I mean, he looks like a pretty strong fairly physical runner. The highlights that you saw, he didn't break a ton of tackles, but he did run through some. I mean, I'll say one thing, you better not try to arm tackle him, because those kind of tackles he ran through really easy. But you would say that about a lot of backs, but he's built solidly. The only thing I saw, and again, I'm not a recruit, Nick, like a, you know, Tyler and all those different guys, but little bit upright is all that I saw, but and I think you can probably get away with that at the high school level. But again, he's very fast. There were not many guys gaining ground on Jameer Smith once he did break through that first or second level.
I should mention he's 5'11 and 198. He's out of Sanford, North Carolina. And he also caught seven passes for 117 yards and a touchdown as a junior, while 24/7 Sports has him as the number 24 running back at the position. Rivals has him at number 17. And, of course, Tyler James has the story in today's South Bend Tribune and also at IndyInsider.com on running back Jameer Smith verbally committing to the University of Notre Dame. Tom Lemming is a guy the Tribune uses a lot for evaluations of these prospects. He is the CBS Sports Network recruiting analyst, and he told Tyler yesterday, quote, "He's close to a four-star back, but not there yet. I don't go by who offers. I go by what I see. I liked him. Physically, he looked like he was a running back. His statistics are great. He's a pounder. He has good vision and balance. This is a good catch. This is a guy that Denson wants. His reputation is on the line with running backs. All the position coaches should recruit like that." Interesting. End quote. So even though he's 5'11", 198, he's considered a pounder by Tom Lemming. So you got Stepp, who I've heard a lot of good things about. I know Mishawaka, I can't remember if he ended up playing against him or not. I thought he was injured, but I could be wrong. I might be thinking about the linebacker, actually, that was at Cathedral, that was committed to Notre Dame for a while. But heard a lot of good things about Stepp. Seems to be a high-end prospect. You add Smith to him, and the running back position should be in good hands going forward, whether Josh Adams departs or comes back for another year with the Fighting Irish. And if Josh Adams stays healthy, that's the key. It sure seems like he is really set up for a big year. And then you got Dexter Williams, who's kind of considered almost like a scat back, but I know he doesn't want to be called a scat back. He wants to be a complete player, working on his blocking skills. And then you got Tony Jones Jr., who, if anybody's kind of a pounder, it's 5'11", 224, a sophomore, but he's showed pretty good speed, I thought, during spring workouts this year. So with Adams, Williams, and Jones, and we'll see about C.J. Holmes as a freshman, if he can contribute at all. We're going to see, more than likely, according to Chip Long, the offensive coordinator, a lot of running backs coming in and out due to the tempo. So it's going to be all hands on deck right now at that running back position, even though Adams is the guy. I mean, it sounds like you're going to see Williams, and maybe you're going to see Tony Jones Jr. They will go through running backs to keep them fresh, and that's an advantage for the offense when you can go a little deeper down the depth chart at that position against defenses who are hopefully going to be huffing and puffing against this particular Irish offense and its tempo.
Absolutely. We saw good things from all three of them in the springs. In the spring, obviously, we saw good things from Josh Adams last year. But Tony Jones Jr. was kind of that guy who just kept popping up when we got to see some practices, kept popping up, kept making plays. And so he's kind of an intriguing one himself to see what we'll see from him. But as you said, they talk like we're going to see all three of them quite a bit this year. So should be fun.
Well, it's easy to forget Notre Dame was 80th in the country in rushing last year at just 163.3 yards per game. Adams almost still got to 1,000 yards despite being slowed up by an injury. He was at 933 yards. Williams, 39 carries, 200 yards, 3 touchdowns. You mentioned it. They are emphasizing running the football, and hopefully we will see that September 2nd at Notre Dame Stadium when the Fighting Irish take on the Temple Owls. So what does that mean for quarterback Brandon Wimbush being in an offense that really wants to run the football? Well, I think there's going to be plenty of time for him to throw the pill around, and we're going to talk about Brandon Wimbush in our next segment, and we're going to bring back some audio of Brandon talking from this spring as he prepared at that time to be the Notre Dame starting quarterback coming out of the tunnel September 2nd against Temple. So our Notre Dame Fall Camp preview series continues next as we focus on Brandon Wimbush. And oh, by the way, the White Sox got out of the jam in the eighth inning, and so the White Sox are batting in the top of the ninth inning, leading the Cubs by a score of 3-1. It looks like the game is now moving to the bottom of the ninth, so we'll see who pitches for the White Sox in search of the final three outs of the ball game. Sean Stiers, Darren Pritchett, this is Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat on Michiana Sports Leader, 96.1 FM WSBT, brought to you by Budweiser. Great times are waiting. Grab some Buds and Legacy Heating and Air. Sports Beat continues on Michiana Sports Leader, 96.1 FM WSBT. Sean Stiers in our studios. I'm Darren Pritchett with the South Bend Cubs in Beloit. Cubs and Snappers tonight. Jordan Automotive Group pregame show at 7:45. First pitch at 8 o'clock. As South Bend wraps up the road trip, off day tomorrow. Home game against Lake County Wednesday night at 7:05. Notre Dame football fall camp preview series continues today as we focus on Notre Dame's brand new starting quarterback, Brandon Wimbush. You're going to hear some comments from Wimbush from his media sessions in the spring. But how different of a July 24th it is this year compared to last year when we were in preparation for a quarterback competition in fall camp. And I guess we assumed at some point a starter would have been named. But as we remember in that game down in Austin against the Texas Longhorns, Zaire and Kaiser shared possessions in the first half, and then ultimately in the second half, Kaiser finally took over. And I don't want to say ever look back, because he was pulled, and Zaire, like for example in the Stanford game, came in. So it wasn't full steam ahead for Deshaun Kaiser, but he was the main quarterback for the Irish. So now, on this July 24th, with camp about a week away, we know who the starting quarterback is. It's going to be Brandon Wimbush. I guess we assume Ian Book is going to be the number two after what we saw in the spring game and throughout practice. I think he was more impressive than I anticipated, so I assume he will hold off Montgomery Van Gorder and the newcomer Avery Davis. So I'll tell you what, Sean, I wasn't totally sold on the two quarterback system going into last year. I was hoping it was going to work, thinking about the running possibilities of Zaire and the throwing ability of Kaiser. It did not go as planned, and I mean, who knows how much that affected the offense early on in the season. Although in September the numbers were pretty good, they got a little worse as the season went on, so maybe you can't point to just that. But just having the starting quarterback in place just seems like it's, with that in place, everybody kind of settles into their roles. It's almost like in baseball, when you have your closer, then everybody just falls in line and what their jobs are in the bullpen. Once the quarterback is set, I just feel like you're in such a better frame of mind and you can design your offense around that starting quarterback.
Absolutely. Just what you said right there. You build the whole thing around him and you know what you have. You know what one guy's specific skill set is. You don't have to worry about, okay, if it's this guy, are we running this? If it's that guy, are we running that? Any of that stuff. And then all the other stuff that comes with it, because just naturally, one set of guys is going to gravitate more toward one than the other and vice versa. And you don't have to worry about any of that. You go in, you've got your guy, you don't have any of the distractions, any questions to other members of the team, the coaching staff, anybody about should it be this guy? What do you think about this guy? Any of that kind of stuff. You got one guy and you go forward with him.
I'm going to go off the script for a second and ask you this. As you get ready to watch him in fall camp and then ultimately take the field as the starter against Temple on September 2nd, is there anything you're still curious about that you want to find out about Brandon Wimbush? Now, I think I have to be careful because he's played in a mop-up game against a bad UMass team 2 years ago. I mean, we've saw him in practice. We saw him in the blue goal game. But you know, the lights are going to be bright on September 2nd, his first time as a college starter. So as you get set for this season, is there anything that you're still curious about or want to find out about Brandon Wimbush?
I think that's the biggest thing right there, kind of what you touched on a little bit more on the intangible side. How is he going to deal with being the quarterback at Notre Dame? How is he going to be on game day? How is he going to handle all that extra stuff that comes with being that guy? And then how is he going to, on the field, deal with what comes at him? Because we haven't seen him in a true real play situation. Mop-up duty against UMass is really all that we've seen. How is he going to deal with that first third and long when he has to make a play going downfield? How is he going to deal with at the end of a game, in a game time situation, when he's trying to lead that potential game winning or comeback type drive, or whatever it happens to be? How is he going to handle the pressure that comes with all of that? So it's more along those lines that I'm really still waiting to see from Brandon Wimbush, and we'll all kind of see that at some point.
You know, going back through some of the quotes from the spring, I know one thing that popped up a couple of times when you heard from the coaching staff, including Chip Long, the offensive coordinator, they stressed that the one thing that Brandon is a work in progress on is getting his footwork down. It's something that he is still developing on a consistent basis. And I just thought of that and then thought of how Deshaun Kaiser, when we had Mike Denbrock, the play caller last year, on our program every Monday to recap the previous game, he spent time talking about, even with Kaiser, the inconsistencies of his footwork caused some inconsistencies in him throwing the football. And I know that's something the Browns have focused on too, with Kaiser trying to get that footwork better. And if that gets better, that's going to help his ability to accurately throw the football. So just remembering how Kaiser was a little hit and miss on his footwork. And when you hear Coach Long talk about Wimbush, that once he gets the footwork down, there is not a throw he can't make. Oftentimes coaches don't go out of their way to throw compliments like that, but those are pretty strong words. You're talking about any throw on the football field this kid can make. So I guess I'm curious going into the season, you know, footwork it's easy to get right when it's in practice, but when the bullets are live and you got guys at your feet, you got guys in your face, is Brandon going to be able to execute the fundamentals of his footwork in order to deliver the football accurately? And to me, if he gets that down and he reads defenses like I think he can, that's why I think I'm really excited about Brandon Wimbush. And it's interesting, just going around the minor league ballparks, as you're not going to be surprised, Sean, there's Notre Dame fans everywhere, and I get asked about Brandon Wimbush a lot. And I tell people I feel like that when all is said and done, he's going to be better than DeShone Kizer, and maybe he will have the type of impact in a different way on this team that a guy like Brady Quinn had on the Fighting Irish for several years under Charlie Weiss. That's kind of my belief in Brandon Wimbush. I feel like he is kind of that difference maker, and I tell people I think he's going to be better than DeShone Kizer. They kind of look at me funny, and I'm really surprised. There's a lot of people that follow Notre Dame that still aren't sure how good he's going to be, or really don't know enough about him, just because we haven't seen him on the football field in 2 years. So I think maybe outside of our little bubble, being at practice and seeing him, I think there might be just a little apprehension among some fans yet wondering who Brandon Wimbush is.
Well, that's interesting that you might kind of get those sideways looks or whatever when you say that about being better than DeShone Kizer, because there's still a difference between being an excellent, above average, even whatever, however you want to kind of classify it, college quarterback compared to an NFL prospect quarterback. I mean, just look at Tim Tebow. He won a Heisman Trophy. He was an exceptional college quarterback, and there are a lot of guys, Charlie Ward, just you can go down the list, a lot of guys that you can throw into that category who were really good winning college quarterbacks, but that didn't necessarily make them an NFL prospect or a first round type NFL quarterback. So I sort of subscribe to that as well, because of the combination that he has of the arm strength and the speed and just the physical tools that he had. I think you could see him being even better than DeShone Kizer as a college quarterback.
First off, was that power hitting Tim Tebow you were talking about?
Yeah, that's right.
And I'll never forget when Charlie Ward went into the College Football Hall of Fame when it was in South Bend, had the chance to interview him on JT's show. And first off, he was such a great guy to talk to off the air and on the air. And I asked him on the air, I'm like, I just can't believe that, you know, the football thing didn't work out for you, that you had to play basketball. I didn't put it in those terms, but I remember him telling me, he's like, I had no offers to play football. I go, I find that hard to believe. He's like, I had none. So the success he had at Florida State, he didn't even have an opportunity to play quarterback at the next level. I'm sure the Canadian Football League probably would have been interested, but he chose basketball. I guess everything worked out okay. So since we're focusing on Brandon Wimbush, we have brought back some of his audio from the spring so you can hear from the Fighting Irish starting quarterback. And the first soundbite is just Brandon Wimbush talking about this brand new offense.
Yeah, it's definitely a blend of what Coach Kelly had for us and what he was running here for the past 6 years, and then obviously what Chip is bringing in new. And it's day four. It's really early. And I think we're on track right now, and I think we're at a good spot in the spring to be where we want to be at the end of the spring. So my knowledge of the offense, I think, is at a pretty good point where I can help out the other guys who, you know, are not up to the par where I'm at right now. I mean, a huge difference is the tempo of the offense and the conditioning that we have to sustain to be able to run it efficiently. And I think we've done a great job of implementing the culture, and through the first 3 months of winter training and what Coach Bayless has built, for us to be able to go out there and run Chip's offense efficiently.
Well, first off, it's great to hear that back in the spring, Brandon felt that comfortable in the offense that he could help out other guys. It's good he wasn't swimming and trying to figure things out. If he was that comfortable, the fact he was helping people, that's a really, really good sign for this fall. And as I ask you this next question, I'll just kind of throw in a thought of my own, but I was going to ask, what do you feel like Wimbush is going to look like in this Brian Kelly slash Chip Long offense. And I have a pretty good vision. The only thing I'm not sure of is how the read option fits in. If he's going to be a read option quarterback, how big is that going to be in the offense? Will it be similar to what DeShone Kizer did last year? I mean, he's a breathtaking athlete. Do you run him a little more? That's the one part I think I'm just not sure how the offense is going to look.
Yeah, I know, and that's really the one thing that you have to be worried about, even though he's got a pretty solid frame, 6'1", 226. So it's not like he's slight like Lamar Jackson or something like that, who can still stand to eat a few more peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, I think. But, I mean, that's you don't want him taking too many hits as the quarterback, but at the same time, he does have the speed to really contribute in the running game if that's the way they decide to go. But I'm with you. I am still curious to see what they decide to do with the offense, because it's not a really shock when we say they didn't show us everything in the spring. We still don't know exactly what the full extent of the offense is going to be.
He seems like a kid that's willing to sit in the pocket, let things unfold, even though he's one of those guys that can take off and make a big play out of nothing. And you know what? I think we're going to have some of those breathtaking plays this year from Wimbush. But I see a guy that's willing to stay in the pocket, not leave too early, and deliver the ball down the field. If he gets to that point quickly in the season, I just think this offense could be a whole lot better than it was last year. And in September, they were putting up some really big numbers. Things changed as the season went on. But if he's going to be a guy comfortable in the pocket, which I think he is, wow. You think about the options he has in the passing game, this is going to be a very, very difficult offense for defensive coordinators to try to slow down.
Well, yeah, and that's I think that the one thing, because remember after the Blue-Gold game, there were some people kind of wondering about Wimbush, and then you see Book having a nice game, and people who didn't actually get to see it are asking, oh, is Book better than Wimbush? I mean, there was no doubt watching the two who was the better quarterback. But, I mean, the stat sheet said that Wimbush was sacked 7 times, but that was basically defenders running by him and breathing in his direction to get credit for some of those sacks. I mean, if with his speed and elusiveness, he easily could have rushed for over 100 yards and a couple of touchdowns in that game if it wasn't touch football to tackle the quarterback.
And we've said this all summer, and it's nothing against Ian Book, but he was facing the number two defense,
A
big difference
between
number one and number two, too. I mean, we have to tell the story as is, and I'm not saying Ian couldn't have done great things against the first-team offense or defense. I think he actually played a little bit toward the end against that defense. But you do have to kind of think about that when you're evaluating that piece of paper with the completions and the yardage and the touchdown passes. But he still looked very, very good in that game. He threw the ball on time and on the money, which is a really good sign. Next here is Brandon Wimbush this spring talking about at that time and maybe even this summer what he was trying to improve on.
My overall game, I mean, there's so much to improve on and learning a new offense and kind of building the camaraderie with the guys, and there's so much to improve on. I mean, I can't pinpoint one thing, but if I had to, it'd probably be my pocket presence, making it easier for the guys up front to do their job.
Well, if he gets that pocket presence down, Fighting Irish could be in really, really good shape. He seemed very good in the pocket when I saw him this spring, but that's something he's looking to improve on. So, Sean, when you think back to the spring, what do you feel like you learned about Brandon Wimbush that you maybe didn't know, considering we hadn't watched him play since the Massachusetts game in, 2015,
It
was.
Yeah. Well, just kind of touching on some of the stuff we've hit. I mean, we learned that we know he's fast, and we know he's far and away has the best arm on the team. And then we also saw in that Blue Gold game, he has to be careful with that arm. The interceptions came throwing the ball high and kind of to the middle of the field, and that's where the trouble can come. And you talked about that footwork. That can help that as well. That's kind of like a pitcher. When you look at a pitcher, if he's missing high, missing low, the first two things you look at, where's his arm slot and what's his stride like? And if you just tweak either of those a little bit, you can get a lot different results as far as if you're throwing high or if you're throwing low. And so I think it's one thing to, for Wimbush to throw high when it's to the sideline, especially with the big receiving targets that he has. But he kind of has to rein that in a little bit when it comes to throwing down the middle and just seeing the safeties and that kind of thing.
I sure learned that. Indeed, he does deliver the football a whole lot harder than DeShone Kizer. It's noticeable. There is a big difference. I don't know if people realize that, but Kizer could fling it pretty good. But the velocity for this kid just is a whole lot different. Very, very tight spiral. Seems like a very catchable football. And I'm looking forward to all Irish fans seeing him against Temple show off that great arm. Now, here's a couple of sound bites going back to last year. Here's Brandon Wimbush on what he learned from the sidelines last season.
I was able to go down on the scout team and help the defense out, and I thought that was very beneficial for my improvement, obviously running against the number ones. And then they did sprinkle in some three reps up with the ones and the twos. So, and just being in the meeting rooms with those guys and hearing what they're going through up in the ones and twos and seeing how they, you know, they perform, it was huge for me last year.
Now, just to follow up that soundbite, Wimbush was asked about a little more specifically what he learned from being down with the scout team taking on that number one defense.
It was live reps for me that I wasn't getting necessarily throughout the year, and it was big games. Like, I think it was Virginia Tech, Miami game, so they had me emulating those quarterbacks, and I think I helped out the defense as much as I can with the other scout guys who've done a tremendous job all year. And for me to be able to go down there and kind of get some live reps, like I said, was huge for me. And going into this next season, you know what I mean? So I was kind of sidelined for the majority of the season until late, where he sent me down there to get a few reps, which was awesome.
A little easier to chase down Brad Kaya than Brandon Wimbush if you're the first team defense. No disrespect to Kaya, but exactly. It is what it is.
Yeah.
So as you look ahead to the Temple game, Sean, are you expecting Wimbush to come out of the box and play great? Do you feel like the Irish are going to sort of, and pardon the phrase, but ease him in? Or do you think it's going to be pedal to the metal, and if he needs to throw the football 35 times, they're going to be willing to have Brandon Wimbush throw it 35 times?
I think a lot of that will probably be determined by how confident Brian Kelly, Chip Long, Tom Reese are in Wimbush. If they think he can come out. Now, I don't know that they want to come out all guns blazing. They mm-hmm. could potentially if they really think he can be that guy. But again, you sort of have to gauge it by how you feel he's absorbing his environment, with it being his first college start and all those kind of things. At least he's got the fact he's been in Notre Dame Stadium, he's come out of the tunnel, he's done all those things before, but he's still never done it as the starting quarterback. So, but with it being his first start, it's a home game and all that, I think it makes more sense that you ease him into it, see how things go, lean on that running game early on, and then kind of take it from there and see what you have to do as the game progresses.
I agree with that, but I'm going to be selfish. On the first play, I hope Cameron Smith or Kevin Stefferson is in the game, and I hope we get to see Brandon unleash one right off the bat to kind of set the tone for the season. You know, I just want to see the old deep ball, see how far Brandon can throw it, and let's see what happens. Now, that's selfish, but at the same time, hey, we're there to watch the football game. We want to see something exciting just like the fans, and that would get me very excited on the first play. I mean, a handoff to Josh Adams, I'm okay with that. Hey, yeah, Let's watch Josh run, but I think it's time to let the puppy go down the field a little bit to see what Mr. Wimbush and Smith or Stefferson can do on that first play.
I think that would get a lot of people pretty excited, especially if it connects on that first play. Oh. Man, I mean, that would set the place on fire, and then, yeah.
And then you're going to hear from people in the sense, we're going to go to the national championship.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you see that play?
All it took was one play.
All it took was one play. We're back. All right, a couple of more sound bites from Brandon Wimbush on where he is most confident in himself.
My ability to make plays when things break down in the pocket. And I think that will be a huge asset for not only myself, but as well as the offensive line who maybe miss a block or whatnot. And then I have the guys and the receivers out there to make plays for me, as well as myself getting outside the pocket.
Well, not much to add there. There is that possibility the pocket collapses. He can take off, do a lot of damage. Probably some defenses are going to have a defender spying on Brandon Wimbush. And finally, here is Wimbush talking about his quarterback coach, Tom Reese. I think Eric Hansen is involved in some of the questioning here. Irish starting quarterback Brandon Wimbush talking about his new boss, Tom Reese.
I love him. I mean, I'm in the meeting room with him at least twice a day, so between 8 and 12 times a week. I get to spend a lot of time with him. Obviously, he's 25 years old, 26 years old, so he's fresh out himself, and obviously he knows Coach Kelly's offense, and we get along pretty well.
Do you ever see him play, Brandon? Do you ever see him play?
No? Tommy, yeah, he'll definitely bring up clips of himself in some big time games, though. So you know what I mean. There's a lot of clutch moments that he remembers from his time, and I love to see him play. Love to see him spin.
What's the best advice he's given you, not for on field stuff, but for dealing with being a quarterback?
To be smart. Yep.
And that applies on the field too.
Absolutely. Yeah. That applies in every aspect of your life. To make the right choices, right? Even on the field and off the field. So, especially as a quarterback, you got to make the right choice. You got to make the right reads. And off the field, you got to make the right choice. You have to make the right reads.
And Chip was talking today about the tempo and how he's getting everybody used to it and so forth. Do you like the tempo? And what are your adjustments?
Not to talk about high school, which was 2 years ago, but I feel like my tempo in high school was very similar, and the type of offense with the RPOs was very similar. So I feel like my transition is, you know, just going back in memory and kind of recalling some of the things that I did in high school. So I feel like I've done it successfully so far.
Speaking of high school, you know, and just having watched a couple of your games in high school, it didn't look like you did any zone read or very little, but you did run.
Right.
In this offense, will some of your running come outside of that zone read, or do you?
Yeah, it will. I mean, we have so many good backs, and the guys up front are so powerful, and obviously four of them are returning, so I feel like we're going to be a powerful run team, and I think a lot of my runs will come off, you know, the defense preparing for Josh and Dexter and Tony, and then hopefully they don't let me free, but I feel like I can use my legs tomorrow.
Brandon Wimbush talking about that read option we were discussing just a couple of moments ago. And to defend Tommy Reese, you heard where he was talking about how Tom would bring out some clips of him playing and show it. Now, I asked Tom about that, and Tom said, whoa, 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 whoa. Now, I don't bring out clips of myself, but sometimes in order to go through a conversation with a quarterback, we will bring back some old clips. But it isn't like Tommy just throws them out there, hey, watch me play quarterback. I just have to re-defend Tommy that he was like, no, that's not exactly the way it works.
Did you see this Purdue game?
Remember that play I made back in the day? Notre Dame Fall Camp Preview Series with Brandon Wimbush. We'll have a wide receiver segment on tomorrow's program. Mike Varell's going to fill in for me, joining Sean on the program. And then on Wednesday, we'll get back to a little more Brandon Wimbush conversation as we'll bring back some Tom Reese audio and have him talk about the new starting quarterback of the Fighting Irish. Next, the My 5 question of the day. Who will be Notre Dame's 5 leading tacklers this fall? Answers next on WSBT.
One question, 5 answers. This is the My 5 question of the day on Michiana's sports leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT.
Who will be Notre Dame's 5 leading tacklers this fall? We'll take our guesses right now. Sean will go first with his choice number 5.
I have Dalen Hayes at number 5. From what we saw of him in the spring, he's the most active defensive lineman. Stuffed the stat sheet in the spring. Should have a good tackle total this fall.
I hope that's the case. Number 4.
Greer Martini, their 5th leading tackler last year. He'll move up a spot this year. I would think in the 70 to 80 tackle range.
All right, we're moving along through Sean's list of Notre Dame's 5 leading tacklers this fall. Your choice number 3.
My number 3 is safety Jalen Elliott. Safety always seems to end up in the top 2 or 3, whether it's Drew Tranquil, Elijah Shoemate, Matthias Farley on down the line. Elliott will be there at strong safety, I think.
Number 2.
Is Drew Tranquil moving up to the Rover spot and potentially still some at safety, but he was our 2nd leading tackler as it was last year. Now he's closer to the line. He'll be around the ball all the time, I think.
And I don't think there's any shock who your choice number one is going to be.
Who could it be? Niles Morgan. I would be shocked if we don't both have Niles number one. He was their leading tackler last year, 94. I think we'll see even more this year. Expect him over 100.
All right, my five really quick. I'm going to go with a cornerback. I know Cole Luke was high on the list last year, so I'm going to go with Sean Crawford. I just hope he stays healthy after two serious injuries, his ability to find the football. I snuck Crawford in at number five.
Okay.
Number four, I also put safety Jalen Elliott on my list, playing the strong safety position. And who knows, Aloy Gilman, if he is going to be able to play this year, he might be in the conversation. Number three, I went with Greer Martini as well, fifth on the team last year with 55 tackles, penciled in as the weak side linebacker, so an opportunity for Greer to get on the field a whole lot more this year. Number two, the guy I've hyped in many of these lists, I got Drew Tranquil at number two. I think very quietly the number two tackler last year at 79. If we asked that trivia question, I don't know how many people would have guessed Tranquil, and no doubt, unless he gets hurt, your leading tackler is going to be Niles Morgan, 94 last year, hopefully triple digits for the outstanding middle linebacker this year for the Fighting Irish. That's our My 5 Question of the Day. Sports Beat returns after this on WSBT. Well, speaking of the White Sox, they ended up beating the Chicago Cubs at Wrigley Field today by a final score of 3-1. Adam Engel, Matt Davidson homered for the White Sox. Jose Abreu, an RBI double. And Miguel Gonzalez, 7 1/3 innings, giving up just one run. So that means the Cubs fall back into second place in the National League Central, a half a game behind the Milwaukee Brewers. Rapid Fire is next. Top of the hour, WSBT South Bend.
This is Budweiser's weekday sports beat on your home of the Irish. 96.1 FM, WSBT.
Here's a home run ball. Going for it is Fuller. He's out there. He catches it. Touchdown, Notre Dame.
Jackson with a spectacular spin move. And now the no-look pass to Zach August for the two-handed slam.
Adios. Two-run home run, Gleyber Torres.
Kaiser looks, timing pattern.
Caught. Touchdown, Notre Dame.
Corey Hunter Jr.
One goes down at Notre Dame again.
Here are your hosts, Darren Pritchett and Sean Stiers.
And this is hour number two of Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat, presented by Budweiser. Great times are waiting. Grab some Buds, and by Legacy Heating and Air. Sean Stiers in our WSBT studios. Darren Pritchett with the South Bend Cubs in Beloit, Wisconsin. Snappers and Cubs tonight. 7:45, Jordan Automotive Group pregame show, 8 o'clock, first pitch on 96.1 FM WSBT. And don't forget the Notre Dame football preview put out by Indy Insider is on bookshelves right now. If you're in the South Bend area, wherever you get your favorite magazine, they are available. And if you are listening via WSBTRadio.com or our WSBT Radio app, which is free by going to the Google Play Store or iTunes Store. And if you're outside the area, then you can just order one of these magazines at IndyInsider.com. A lot of great information in the magazine to get you ready for the upcoming season. So make sure you check out the Indy Insider Notre Dame football preview at your favorite magazine rack right now, or you can order online at IndyInsider.com. White Sox beat the Cubs 3-1 this afternoon. More on that in a little bit. But I turn things over to our co-host, Sean Stiers. He has put together the list of thought-provoking questions and statements for another installment of Rapid Fire. I have not seen the questions yet, so I am ready to hear what you have for today.
All right, Swami, let's start with that Sox
Swami
Cubs game. The White Sox the White Sox beating the Cubs today is blank.
Mystifying. Because my dreadful Cardinals just got their tail whipped the last two games, and two games they should have won, but of course they can't close out a game. And then you look at the White Sox, who have nothing going on right now. They're just kind of playing and getting ready for the future, and they absolutely mystify the Cubs bats today as Miguel Gonzalez gives up one run. So I guess I'm a little mystified, and I'm a little jealous that the White Sox could make it look so easy today.
No kidding. And I'll go along the same lines. I'll just say head scratcher. I mean, the White Sox had lost nine games in a row coming into today's game at Wrigley Field. Mm-hmm. They were on the road yesterday. They got walked off again by Kansas City, just like they did all weekend, and it looked like maybe that's the script the Cubs would follow, but unlike Kansas City, the Cubs could not get to the White Sox bullpen. They were 0 for 10 with runners in scoring position were the Cubs and left 12 men stranded. So it's kind of back to that roller coaster, at least for today. We'll see how the next three games play out. Not a good way to start off for them, though.
You know, even as a broadcaster, what it's like when the team you're covering has a night game and then you have to play early in the afternoon.
True, too.
It's a tough turnaround now. The White Sox had to travel in from Kansas City, but I have a feeling maybe that quick turnaround and that emotional series against St. Louis might have had something to do with it today. I don't want to take anything away from the White Sox, but, I mean, as someone that even though we don't play, just the travel and getting up, I guess after a night game, it can be a little challenging, so I don't want to make excuses for the Cubs, but I'm sure that was a small portion of the outcome of the game.
Well, and it had to feel good for Rick Renteria as well.
Yeah,
because
that's true.
As big an upgrade as it was, and for the Cubs to go out and get Joe Maddon a couple of years ago, it was not a good ending for Renteria, just the way it was handled and everything. And so this is his first game back at Wrigley Field, leading the White Sox and leading of an obviously depleted White Sox team that's traded off the bulk of its talent over the last week or so. So it had to be good for him, even if it only ends, if it does end up only being one game that they win in this series, for him to get this one today had to feel pretty good for him.
You know, I kind of forgot about him because he did a really nice job in 2014. They really turned the corner in the last couple of months, and you kind of saw the future coming. And he was given a lot of credit for helping these young guys with the major league grind and did a great job. Now, at the same time, if you're Theo Epstein and you have a chance to bring in a guy like Joe Maddon, it's unfortunate a guy like Renteria is in the wrong place at the wrong time, and he did a nice job. But, you know, Maddon is a high-end manager, and, well, the rest is history that Theo obviously did the right thing, but Renteria deserved another opportunity because he did nothing wrong.
No.
With his time with the Cubs to be let go, but it was just circumstance, and you're right, he's now going to have the chance to do the same thing with the White Sox that he was a part of with the Cubs. I just hope he gets to stick around a little longer this time to see it through.
Well, absolutely, because his record over the next few years is not going to be good, and the big thing is doing the things like you were talking about, keeping the young guys' heads in it, helping them develop and bringing them along, and hopefully he does manage to get to the point a few years down the road where they do start seeing some of that talent come back, and he's able to lead those guys as well.
I'm going to steal from the Philadelphia 76ers, but it's true. Trust the process, and
there
that's what the White Sox have to do right now under Renteria. And by the way, for White Sox fans over the weekend, one of the guys you got in the Jose Quintana deal, Eloy Jimenez, who of course played in South Bend last year, had his first five-hit game for the White Sox Advanced A Club. So Eloy with his first five-hit game, and he is smoking the ball right now in the White Sox organization.
Yep. All right, another baseball question. Major League Baseball's trade deadline, of course, a week away. All indications are the Cubs are still in play to add at least another pitcher, so a toss-up for you. Do you think a starting pitcher or a reliever is the bigger priority right now?
I'm just not banking on it being a high-end starter. I just don't think they have the bullets that they want to trade to do that. They're not going to trade Happ or Baez. Now, if they're willing to do that, then they'll get that starting pitcher of the high-end guy, but I don't think that's reality. Boy, that's a great question. They just have no pitching help in the minors to help that bullpen. And, you know, the rotation has been better lately, so I hate to take my foot off the gas on wanting that starting pitcher. But if Henricks comes back, I know he threw a lot of pitches today to get 13 outs, probably wasn't as sharp, but again, he had not pitched in a major league game in 7 weeks. I would think with Lester, Quintana, Henricks, that they can weave their way through this, and that would be enough to win the division. I'm just worried about the bullpen a little bit. The seventh inning just is right now a wart as I look at the Cubs. Davis is great in the ninth inning. Yeah, it's just I know their middle reliever is Grimm. I'd like to see them add someone to take his spot, but there's just everybody they brought up from Iowa just does not have any success. The young pitching is farther down on the chain to help them. So, Sean, I'm actually going to change up my thought right now. With Hendricks coming back, assuming that he'll be okay, I'm going to say it may not be bad for them to even add two arms in the bullpen. I think a lefty might come in handy,
yep,
even though they have Montgomery down there. But I think that classic guy that is brought in just to get a lefty out would be helpful. And I would not mind one more strikeout arm in that bullpen.
Yeah, and that's heading into today's game, their starters, a 2.41 ERA since the All-Star break. And it goes up a little bit because Hendricks only went 4 1/3, and there is some concern there. But no one before Hendricks allowed 8 hits today. None of the previous 10 pitchers had even given up 5 hits, starting pitchers. And so when you look at they've not only got 2 wins and 2 good starts from Jose Quintana since the trade, but it kind of seems to have had a ripple effect. They've got much improved starts from the rest of the rotation. 19 of the 36 runs, though, they've allowed in the second half. That includes today. 19 of 36 runs have come from the bullpen. And now a couple of those have been really big bursts, the one by St. Louis and the one by Baltimore as well. But my vote leans toward reliever being the bigger priority now as well, because unless they can get that starter who's got a couple years of control still, which doesn't look realistically like it's going to happen now. And I just look at, you kind of have to have an eye toward not just getting through this season, but what happens when you get to the postseason as well, based on last year, because they don't have Aroldis Chapman now to go out there and work all the multiple innings. And who do you trust is what it comes down to when you're talking about relieving in the postseason. And besides Wade Davis and Carl Edwards, there aren't a whole lot of guys who I think Joe Maddon really trusts. And Wade Davis is not going to be that multiple inning guy like Chapman was last year, where he can go out and consistently give you 2. Because I still think, just watching him, they've kind of babied him at times with his rest and all that different kind of stuff. And maybe some of that is with an eye toward September and October and all that as well. But I feel like there are some different options out there. Zach Britton is a guy who keeps being talked about, the Orioles lefty. Brad Hand for the Padres as well. And I know Britton's not pitching that well, but Hand is a guy with San Diego who has really good numbers, and he's a lefty like you were talking about. But I would agree with what you're saying. If you can go out and get 2, I think that they'd feel like they're in a lot better shape. But I guess, just like with everything, the question is, what 2 is it going to be? And what Joe Maddon says, are they going to be considerable upgrades from what's already on the roster?
And I'm going to partially alter my answer. I think 2 is still a good answer, but I think it's more important, the more I think about it, to get that lefty specialist.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking, even though Edwards had that rough game Friday against St. Louis, he came back last night. I think he walked the first guy, got the next 3. I mean, he's got like 58 or 60 strikeouts in 40 innings. Strope makes me nervous from time to time. Rondon, maybe they've got enough from the right side to get it done, especially if Edwards is firing bullets. But I think that lefty just kind of looms right now as something that would really be icing on the cake for that bullpen right now.
Absolutely. If they had a guy, if they had some combination of 3 to 4 guys who they could really feel confident, 7th, 8th, 9th innings, I think a lot of teams would be really happy with that. But the way the Cubs are built right now, I think they'd be ecstatic if they had at least one more, and then potentially one more on top of that arm. They can go out there and really feel confident for those 7th, 8th innings, especially before Wade Davis.
And let's just throw in the fact how confident Maddon was in some of those guys in the playoffs last year.
Well, yeah, and that's
exactly it.
He avoided
them like the plague.
That's exactly it. There's a reason he had to rely on Chapman so much, and it's because he didn't have confidence in those guys. Okay, so kind of along those same lines, over under 1.5 more trades the Cubs are going to make in the next week before the deadline.
1.5 more trades?
Yes.
Ooh.
So that means either, potentially 1 or 2.
Sean, I'll go over because I still think they'll get that veteran backup catcher.
Right.
And they will get a reliever. You know, the perfect scenario would be just to call up the Tigers, say, give us Alex Avila, the catcher, and give us Justin Wilson, left-handed reliever, and we'll call it a day. But what they have to give up for that is a whole different ball game. But if you're going to do some quick shopping, that would take care of both of those in one big swoop.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, I think they've got to, because as good as Wilson Contreras has been, he's just playing too much right now. And you talk about day game after a night game and all that stuff. They need a veteran they can put back there a couple of times a week, because he can't be absorbing all that right now. They need that veteran to go with him. And I'm going over as well, because it's sounding more and more like it's either going to be Avila or LaCroix. And then I think they've got to go out and get some kind of arm as well. So I'll say at least two moves.
With this team, as good as they can be, and they just need some depth pieces. I don't know if there's going to be anything that's going to wild Cub fans over the next week, but they're going to do some small little things to set them up for the postseason.
Yeah, it very well could be a name that we haven't heard of, just like a Brad Hand. I don't think that most Cubs fans know who Brad Hand is, but he's a very good reliever for a very bad team in San Diego. And there are some guys like that out there who I think could be moved here this week that maybe you haven't heard of him, but when you look at his numbers, it's like, oh, that could really work out down the stretch.
Pitched perfectly.
Yep.
I agree.
Okay. Switch to some football. According to the Chicago Tribune, Notre Dame and Wisconsin are in talks to play some football at both Soldier Field and Lambeau Field. So scale of 1 to 10, what do you think of a Fighting Irish Badgers series in Chicago and Green Bay?
I mean, it makes sense. I mean, I got to give that a 10. It's been several decades since they played. I know there is a lot of Big Ten Notre Dame matchups coming up the next 8-9 years. So you got to be careful how many that you put on there. But to me, I think that's extremely exciting. Notre Dame plays extremely well at Soldier Field. In fact, I don't think they've ever lost there, if I'm remembering correctly. And a chance to go to Lambeau Field, I think it's – yeah, okay, there you go. So it's great for the kids. It's great for the programs. There's going to be extra buzz about the game, kind of like when LSU and Wisconsin played at Lambeau Field. The only thing that would top it off, go over to Resch Arena, which is on the Lambeau Field parking lot where the Green Bay Gamblers play in the United States Hockey League, and we'll do a little Notre Dame-Wisconsin maybe one or two nights centered around that football game. That would make it absolutely perfect. Don't know if we can work that out, but in terms of Lambeau, Soldier Field, Wisconsin, Notre Dame, you get two great programs. I mean, Wisconsin's been so good for the last three decades. You know they're going to be a tough opponent. You know what they're going to do. You get two great venues. I mean, I can't find a negative yet in this whole conversation.
Absolutely. They haven't played since 1964 and all the stuff you're talking about. And how did I know, by the way, you'd bring it back to hockey? How did I know that?
Because one of my good friends who is in East Lansing, who listens to our show on his phone as he drives home, and he's probably listening right now, brought up the suggestion, so I'm stealing from him. I think it was a heck of an idea.
I think I did see that tweet, by the way. But, I mean, yeah. You're talking about Wisconsin, 15 straight bowl games going back to 2002. It's really kind of amazing.
Is that the streak?
I went and looked him up. I'm like, man, that's, I mean, you talk about a team with a little teeth coming with them all the way back to 2002, 15 straight bowl games. So, and Barry Alvarez, you've got a Notre Dame connection there. It's really amazing that it's been since 1964 that they played. So I'm with you. It's a 10. The Soldier Field part of it doesn't get me excited, but when you throw in the Lambeau Field part of it, that's really, and Wisconsin and LSU played there last year, so you throw Lambeau Field into it, and that really ratchets it up quite a bit.
Yeah, I'm just looking here. Notre Dame will play Michigan State this year. They won't play the Spartans until 26 and 27. You've got Michigan and Northwestern next year. You got Michigan again in 19. You have Purdue in 20 and 21. Ohio State in 22 and 23. Purdue in 24 and 25. So you've got Big Ten teams on the schedule each of the next 11 years, but there are a few years where there's only one Big Ten opponent. So absolutely, you can make it work. And yeah, the last time the Irish were there, the Miami game during that run to the title game when they just absolutely clobbered the Hurricanes 41-3.
Yep. And none of us had internet, but that's another story.
Oh, my goodness. There were a lot of obstacles that night, to say
right.
the least.
That's right. All right, a Washington, D.C. columnist thinks a great way to speed up Major League Baseball games, Darren. I'm really interested to see what you think about this. Great way to speed up games would be to have foul balls count as strike three, just like bunts. So, in other words, if it's a two-strike count and you foul a ball off at strike three, you're done. In order to speed up games. Buy or sell the idea?
That's the most ridiculous thing I've heard all day.
Big sell for me as well, by the way. To end the suspense.
You're telling me, this guy's telling me, with guys throwing 98 and 99, that you're supposed to be able to square that up
exactly.
when there's two strikes, and if you don't, you're out. I mean, that's the silliest thing I've ever heard. Somebody actually wrote that in a column, and
yes.
they were not doing it tongue-in-cheek.
No. And to me, I mean, think of Wade Boggs and Tony Gwynn. If you took away all their hits with two strikes, I don't know what the number is, but they totaled over 61 hits together. I've got to imagine that a pretty high percentage of their career hits came with two strikes because of the way they hit. I mean, think about Kirk Gibson. How many pitches he fouled off in that at-bat before hitting that home run against Dennis Eckersley in the World Series. I mean, it's ridiculous. And I agree with what you're saying as well. And baseball is already suffering from a lack of action with the all-or-nothing approach. And so if you change that rule, foul balls or strike three, you're going to have even less things going on the field if you take that out of play.
All right, let me see here. So this is Major League Baseball players' batting averages pending the count.
Okay.
So let's look at two strike counts. So let's use 2009 as a barometer.
Okay.
When a batter had an 0-2 count in Major League Baseball in 2009, they hit 156, 1-2, 171, 2-2, 189, full count, 233. So on top of being very mediocre when you have two strikes, you're asking them to put the ball in play, you're going to be out.
Right. Did we lose Darren there, Jerry? I think we lost Darren Pritchett. Definitely we lost Darren Pritchett. So I tell you what we're going to do. It is 627, coming up on 627 on Michiana Sports Leader 96.1 FM WSBT. We are going to reconnect with Darren Pritchett, who's with the South Bend Cubs in Beloit, Wisconsin, getting ready for the game tonight on WSBT. So we're going to reconnect with Darren during the break. And then when we come back, we will either continue with a little bit more rapid fire. We'll at least try to continue with this topic that we were talking about. We will do that. And then we've got a few other things we're going to talk about as well. Budweiser's weekday sports beat on Michiana Sports Leader 96.1 FM WSBT.
Abby, thanks for the forecast. Sean Stiers, Darren Pritchett with you. Sports beat on WSBT Radio. I apologize. Someone pulled the plug here.
Man.
Lost my connection a couple of times. So I found a new way to connect, and hopefully we'll be good to go for the rest of the program and throughout the South Bend Cubs game tonight.
Oh, boy. I think we just lost him again. Looks like we did. So I'll try to kind of go on for a little bit while Jerry Janowski, our studio engineer, tries to get him connected once again. Darren Pritchett live up in Beloit, Wisconsin, getting ready for South Bend Cubs baseball coming up tonight here on Michiana Sports Leader 96.1 FM WSBT. And Darren and I, before we were cut off, is he back?
I'm here, I think.
All right.
We
heard kind of a and then you were gone. And
oh, jeez.
So now you're back. So
maybe.
It's been a good night for technology, hasn't it? Or not?
Yeah, my engineer's working on it right now.
No kidding. Man.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's okay.
I'm going to keep talking, and I'm assuming someone's going to hear me. I'll just say that.
Yeah, that's right. We would hope, right?
That's
okay.
Right.
All right. Well, finishing up the thoughts that we had, we were talking about that proposal a Washington, D.C. columnist made about speeding up Major League Baseball games by having foul balls, two-strike foul balls, count as strike three, just like on bunts. Like if you bunt a two-strike pitch foul, you're out. That's it. Or same thing in softball. If you foul off what would be strike three, it's strike three. And we were both pretty much against it. And you were kind of getting into the major league batting average on two strike pitches as it was, or as it is.
Yeah, and you're below 200 as a batter in Major League Baseball when you get two strikes on you. I mean, 3-2 is a 233 average, so it's ridiculous to say that you hit a foul ball with two strikes, you're out. I mean, that's just changing the game. You can't change the game the way it's been played for so many years just to take a few minutes off the game. I mean, I just can't believe someone actually put that in print on an article on the internet that that's one way to speed up the game. It's just...
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, there's no doubt that it would speed up the game. Foul balls account for, according to Major League Baseball research, they account for 17.5% of pitches thrown. So, I mean, there's no doubt it would speed up the game, but it also changes the way the game is played. And it's just way too drastic to even consider something like that.
It's like Canadian Football League, three downs. It just doesn't make sense
to
me.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, speaking of speeding up games and length of games, college football wants to speed up its games, which are averaging nearly 3.5 hours. So what would you do to at least try to get closer to 3 hours, which is right around the NFL average? What would you do if you're college football to try to accomplish that?
Wow. Well, the one thing we can't do is cut down commercial breaks for television.
Yeah, we
because
know that,
that's
right?
going to cost them money. So we can take the most obvious and the best way to speed up the game and throw that out the window. I mean, Sean, I guess I'm okay with the way the game of football is played. I mean, sure, I'd like to see a little shorter commercial breaks, but that's not reality. We're both in the radio business. We understand how this works, and these television groups have to get their money back. They're spending a lot of money making these colleges very, very rich with these television contracts. So, I mean, that's not realistic. I really can't think of anything that I would honestly change to make college football quicker. It's a great game the way it is. The only thing that comes to mind is maybe going to the NFL philosophy and not stopping the clock on every first down.
Right.
Is it okay now with all the up-tempo offenses to go ahead and just keep the clock running? So if you have to have an answer, I would say at this point with the way college football is played, let the clock run and don't stop it every time they have to move the chains to get ready for another first down.
Yeah, and they've made a little bit of a tweak where halftime is only supposed to last 20 minutes now, and they're supposed to be trying to keep the schools on this, so that'll be interesting to see how that goes. But I agree with what you're saying. It would probably cut a good 5 minutes off a game, or at least four, if they did what you said right there. If you didn't stop the clock on every first down, and maybe you adjust it by saying, for the most part, you're not, but then once you get under 2 minutes in each half, you could stop it on first down, something like that. The replay rule, to me, needs to change as well, because in theory, every play of a game can go to the replay booth, and you see a lot more plays typically reviewed in college football because of that rule. I don't know, again, why they can't just go to the NFL rule. You give the coaches a set amount of challenges so that you don't have every play reviewed, and even the targeting rule, because of the way targeting is done, that it goes to the replay booth and all that stuff, and just consistency with all that. I think those are some easy tweaks right there where you could shave some time down if you changed a few of those things.
I like that. I can live with those.
All right. Other than that, I agree with what you're saying. In general, I mean, I'm not totally against length of time, just like with baseball, especially if you're in the stadium and you're enjoying the environment and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, when you're pushing 3.5 and even in a lot of cases 4 hours for a college football game, I do think that when you're between 3.5 and 4 hours, I think that is a bit too much for my liking.
Yeah. It would be nice, but you know, I mean, the long commercial breaks have something to do with that.
That's
not
true.
All of it, but that's, you know, the first down thing, I would not be upset if that changed.
Now what about, because the golf tournament over the weekend, Open, the British Open, whatever you want to call it, they did some of the kind of picture-in-picture type stuff with the commercials. Did you see any of that?
Like they do for the Indy 500 and NASCAR.
Right.
I noticed that.
Do you think that would work in football, or is that even in baseball, or is that too much?
I don't think the viewer would be very happy about that. I got to be honest, I get extremely annoyed as a person who watches sports on regular TV when there is a flash flood watch or there's some sort of watch weather-wise that they make the screen smaller and put up the weather information.
Mm-hmm.
I get kind of frustrated when that happens during sporting events because it takes away from the screen and sometimes it changes the angle of what you're seeing. Now, don't get me wrong. When there is severe weather, I totally get that. But as someone that gets frustrated when there's a watch on the screen and it changes the look of the screen, I get frustrated. So I will say this. I'll speak for myself. I don't know if I would like that in football because I want to see the full picture when I'm watching a football game.
That's a good point. And this is different but the same at the same time. It's probably been about a month or so ago. We were watching some show at home, and then they broke in with weather, and It clipped off the last 3 minutes of the show, so we didn't get to see the show end as a result. Now, like you said, if someone's life is in danger, I understand. You cut in, you do what you got to do. But it was a little frustrating when you're watching a show and you missed the end.
We had that with the Indy 500 a few years ago.
Yep, that's right. That's right. All right, that's what we have for Rapid Fire today.
All right, very good. It is now 6:42 on your home of the Fighting Irish, 960 AM and 96.1 FM. WSBT, Sean Stiers, Darren Pritchett with you on this installment of Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat on 96.1 FM, WSBT. Let's go through some odds and ends while we have a moment. Things that happened from the weekend that caught our attention. I'll bring up the first one, and that is Jordan Spieth winning the 146th Open Championship last year. We had quite a duel coming down the stretch as you had two golfers playing absolutely out of their mind, and there was very rarely many bad shots down the stretch. Now, this year, there was a lot of ups and downs, but nevertheless, it was very, very entertaining as Jordan Spieth bogeyed three of his first four holes and then had the enormous amount of trouble on 13. His tee shot went way right. And it went near the practice range where all the manufacturer semis are. And they couldn't find the ball in the weeds. So then they had to find a place to drop the ball. And they're looking in between the trucks and they're looking here. And somehow he made bogey out of that. Then came back the next hole and stuck it on the par 3 for birdie. And then he makes an eagle on the par 5, 15th. And just absolutely retakes control of the golf tournament. 5 under par the last 5 holes. And Matt Kuchar ends up losing by 3 shots. When there was a moment, you felt like he had a heck of a chance to win up by a shot on the back 9. But people say Spieth has that thing, and you can't put your finger on what that thing is. But he is able to turn it on. Now, he's come up short in majors. He hasn't been able to close them all out. He had a miscue at the Masters a couple of years ago, a second at the PGA. So he's not perfect, nor is any golfer. Everybody has those tough moments in the game of golf. But he just absolutely took control of that golf tournament right after he went through, I'm sure, a lot of emotions on the 13th hole, trying to figure out how the heck he's going to get the ball back in play. And even though it wasn't as perfect as the 18 holes we watched last year, but at the same time, that was quite the entertainment. Kuchar played well, but Spieth just has that extra gear that a lot of people want. And I know he gave a lot of credit to his caddy for keeping him focused, and he was down after the first few holes emotionally, but he bounced back, and to play the last 5 holes and 5 under par with all that pressure and all the bad things that had happened that day, he had many reasons to be negative. He found another gear, and now he has won 3 legs of the career Grand Slam. He's the second youngest to do that outside of Jack Nicklaus and has a chance to complete the Grand Slam for his career at the PGA Championship next month in North Carolina. And I'll say this, on the golf show on Saturday mornings with Tim Firestone and John Foster, we've talked about it's been a very boring PGA Tour season. There hasn't been a lot of memorable moments. I think this was one of those times where it was a very memorable final round just because of the roller coaster ride Spieth was on, and to see him excel coming down the stretch at such a young age was so very, very impressive. That might be the highlight of the golf season. Spieth out of the bunker a couple of weeks ago to win the PGA Tour event, and then what he did the final five holes to win the Open Championship.
Yeah, and I think when you look at it, you mentioned the career Grand Slam, and he's 23. He turns 24 in just 3 days, actually. I was just pulling up to find out when he turns 24. But if he wins that PGA, he would be the youngest to ever do that, to have the Grand Slam in his career. He'd be the youngest to ever have that if he can win the PGA here in a couple of weeks. And you talk about that extra gear, and I mean, I'm not saying he's Tiger Woods, but to have that extra gear, that is very Woods-ish. I mean, that's mm-hmm. that's along those lines, and he's obviously at just 24 already setting himself up to possibly be one of the all-time greats.
Well, just to put this in perspective, when you think about in the early 90s, when the Dallas Cowboys were winning three championships in 4 years, and they had all of those, loud voices that turned off a lot of people. And what happened? When you're the winning team, everybody wants to beat you. Everybody wants to see them lose. I think we go through that with the Patriots right now. Mm-hmm. We go through it with Alabama. They're the dominant school, and everybody wants them to get beat because they're tired of them winning. But I think in the game of golf, we almost need someone to kind of take hold, not necessarily to the level that Tiger did, because I think there's more balance right now, and there's a lot of great golfers to latch on to. But I kind of feel like we need at least one dominant guy for everybody to shoot at, and maybe Spieth will be that guy, because with all the parity right now in golf, it's been kind of an uneventful golf season. So if Spieth can become that guy, and again, I don't think he needs to be Tiger dominant. I think it's good for the game to see that one guy that's the face of golf and everybody trying to knock him off the pedestal.
I think every sport needs that, but I think you're right, because golf right now, Tiger Woods, he was the face of golf for a long time, and really golf now is still sort of looking for who that next face is going to be. And just regardless of sport, whether you love or hate the Golden State Warriors, they're not going to be the Los Angeles Lakers, but they need a team like that, and really they need Golden State Cleveland to kind of have that rivalry, because there's so much of basketball that isn't as interesting without that big team. And baseball, they need the Yankees. Baseball is just more interesting when the Yankees are good to either pull for or against than any of the sport. But like you said, the mm-hmm. Patriots still make football interesting, yeah, because you want to either have that villain or have that team that you're rooting for. They all need that, I think.
If they're 10-0, you know, everybody's going to be rooting against them. They do not want to see Bill Belichick and Tom Brady go 16-0 again and then a chance to go 19-0. Pretty much the whole world will be rooting against that. But in golf, I think it would be good if Spieth kind of becomes the face of golf.
Absolutely. I think it'd be
good,
too.
How about you? What stood out to you from this weekend?
Well, there are a couple different things that I had, but I thought I'd start with this. Okay. This whole... You know, it's the Shark Week thing is here. And David Phelps was doing this match race against a shark. Did you hear the details about the shark today? Did you hear what happened?
I was watching Good Morning America today, and I saw Michael Phelps in the water taking on a shark that wasn't even real.
Right. It was a CGI shark. They did all this stuff to pump up this David Phelps racing against the shark, and then they didn't even have a real shark in the water.
Which kind of makes sense. When I heard this, I'm like, how can you put a human against a shark, A, without something bad happening,
right,
and B, how are you going to get the shark to go straight toward the finish line? I just wasn't sure how they were going to do that. It's not like you can put a piece of fresh meat, because he might turn to his right and see another fresh piece of meat, and unfortunately Michael Phelps would be the meal. But I mean, Michael Phelps is a husband, a father. I mean, he's not going to do something stupid. So when I heard this, I kind of just blew it off, like, okay, this just can't be what it is made out to be. And sure enough, I think a lot of people, it sounded like, were very disappointed turning into that show last night.
And that's with what you were saying, how the logistics of how you actually have a shark in the water with a guy with a man to race. And I didn't know if they'd have some kind of cage or something, almost like a lane out there to separate them or what. Turned out they didn't need any of that, because they just, I don't know, went to Disney or somebody and came up with a CGI shark. So I don't get why you go to all the trouble of promoting something like that if you're not even going to have a real shark in the water. But took care of that. The other thing, Darren, was this whole Kyrie Irving thing. And I'm sure that you've heard about it. He says he's tired of being in LeBron James' shadow, wants to be the main man somewhere else. And I've heard a lot of different stuff over the last few days, but he wants to be traded. He's demanding a trade from Cleveland, and I heard initially that it stemmed from his feelings were hurt, basically, because there was talk that he was going to be included in some other trade, and that's what upset him. And then you also now hear that he doesn't want to play second fiddle to LeBron James. And I don't know about you, but I look at this and I'm going, okay, they have been now in three straight NBA finals together. Right. They've won one of them. They've lost a couple others. But to me, I guess I just don't understand how being the man would supersede the ability to have a chance to win championships every year, because you're getting paid either way. And if he does get traded, that also, or Kyrie Irving, that takes away from his ability to get one of these max contracts, because he would then be with another team.
I kind of looked at it from two different standpoints. Number one, how many players in the NBA would get down on their hands and knees and beg to play with LeBron James?
Right.
And Kyrie Irving has that opportunity, and he does not want to play with LeBron anymore. To me, this is more about the future than now. If you believe all of the perceptions that LeBron James will opt out after this coming season and become a free agent, leave Cleveland again. We have to go through that again.
Yeah.
And ultimately maybe go to the Lakers. Well, what is Kyrie Irving left with in Cleveland? They're known as one of the cheapest organizations in the NBA. They got rid of their general manager. They wanted Chauncey Billups to take over. They offered him way below the norm for a GM in the NBA. The guy who got fired was making pretty much nothing compared to most GMs in the NBA. You take a look at the future of the Cavaliers. They're not going to have a nucleus. They're not going to be able to attract great players to Cleveland once LeBron is gone. And I don't mean to speak poorly about Cleveland, but, I mean, to me, Cleveland will fall back into the category of an Atlanta, maybe a New Orleans, a Utah, as not a place that many people are going to want to play since LeBron is not there. So, to me, I think it's Kyrie looking at the big picture, knowing that LeBron's going to leave. It's going to happen again, and I'm going to be left trying to win 30 games with a bunch of hacks. So he's trying to get out of Dodge to a better team now early before what could happen after next year. So I think maybe he wants to be the main guy, and I'm not denying that, but I just look at what Cleveland could be next year, and it's not nearly the same as the team we've talked about the last few years.
Well, no, if LeBron James does in fact leave, and yes, all indications are saying that that's what he's going to do after this season, then
you
think
Kyrie knows?
They're going to be.
Think LeBron has told him that answer? I mean, honestly, I'm asking.
You would think so.
I think they would have to have a good sense of what's going to happen, I would think.
You would think so. But at the same time, two things are going to happen, regardless of if Kyrie Irving is, well, one thing is definitely going to happen, regardless of where Kyrie Irving is this year. Cleveland is going back to the NBA Finals, so they can trade him, get something back, but whoever is riding shotgun with LeBron James is going to the NBA Finals this year. And the other thing is, no matter where Kyrie Irving goes, he's not going to carry a team. He's still not going to be that guy. He's a nice scorer now. Yeah, he can find a shot and do all those things, but he is not going to carry a team in the East or the West to an NBA Finals by himself. It's just not going to happen. He's just John Wall in Washington, or Isaiah Thomas in Boston, or even James Harden in Houston prior to getting these pieces that they've got right now. It's just not going to happen.
Danny Ainge online, too. He's got a question about Cleveland in the finals this year.
Well, he might. I don't see it happening, though.
All right.
I don't think Hayward's enough.
I've got a baseball thought, but let's get the final break out of the way. Some things happened this weekend that down the line could be very helpful for the Cubs. We'll tell you about that next on WSBT. Looks like the Royals and the Padres have made a trade.
I just saw that.
Brandon Maurer, Trevor Cahill, Ryan Buchter to the Royals, and Matt Strom, Travis Wood, infielder Esturi Ruiz and cast considerations go to the San Diego Padres.
And that's
Trevor Cahill, the old Cub.
Yeah, no kidding. Maurer has 20 saves. I just looked him up during the break. He's got a high ERA, but I kind of scrolled through his game by game. He's got a handful of games where he kind of blew up, and he's got a lot of zeros otherwise. So we'll see.
Royals have Cahill through 17, Maurer through 19, Buckter through 21. So a little trade. Royals trying to beef up for the stretch drive. Real quick, I mentioned some things. You don't want injuries to happen to anybody, but things that happened in the National League yesterday could affect things down the line. Clayton Kershaw, the Dodgers, left yesterday's game in the second inning with a back injury. And when I left my hotel, the talk was he was going to go on the DL and maybe miss 4 to 6 weeks. They hope he'll be back for September. And then you have Steven Strasburg leaving yesterday's game. The Nationals started with arm stiffness, and those are two of the top competitions for the Cubs if they make the postseason to win the National League pennant, and those are two key guys for both of those teams. Obviously, Kershaw, he's struggling in the postseason, but you want him healthy and you want him on your team, but those are two things to kind of watch to see how they unfold, and maybe that affects the trade deadline as well. All right, Sean, we'll talk to you on Wednesday. You and Mike Varell will take care of things tomorrow.
All right, sounds good. Have a good one.
You too. Cubs baseball starts in 45 minutes on WSBT South.